imagine this scenario, if you will. You're the CEO of a fast-growing Chinese tech company, and you pulled off the acquisition of a moderately popular lip-syncing app. You then rebrand the app, you fortify the tech and the algorithm, and it takes off around the world, like rocket ship growth, even in the US, especially in the US. You pull off a pretty nice coup by hiring a media executive to be the new CEO of the app. You become, truly, the first Chinese tech leader to create an app that actually has exploded in the US. Yes, you're from China, which has a touchy relationship with American tech companies, but you've always been a huge admirer of Silicon Valley leaders. Then you run into what most academics would call a geopolitical shitstorm. You get banned in India. US government officials threaten to ban the app. You start scrambling for options until finally you figure out you can sell the app in pieces, maybe in whole, to Microsoft. Why Microsoft? It's complicated. Then the President of the United States releases a statement saying you have 45 days to pull off the deal. Otherwise, it's over. Lights out in the U.S.
Here's the deal. I don't mind if, whether it's Microsoft or somebody else, a big company, a secure company, very, very American company, buy it.
So you are Zhang Yiming, CEO of ByteDance. Your app is TikTok. This is Tom Dotan, a reporter at The Information. It's safe to say that in all my years in covering tech, I have never seen anything like this, ever. But while the US press has been obsessed with the unfolding drama with TikTok, us too, there's another side of the story. How is Yiming being perceived in China as all this goes down? So on this episode of The Information's 411, I speak to one of our reporters in Hong Kong, Yunnan Zhang. Our bureau out there has been writing about TikTok longer than anyone, and Yunnan and I get into how things are faring for Yiming back at home. Then in the next segment, Corey Weinberg interviews our reporter Kate Clark about Headspin, the mobile app testing company that gave, let's say, overly rosy projections about its revenue. And then it had to, walk that back and give back some of the money. This is not something that you see every day. So that's the conversation between Corey and Kate. But before we get to that, let's talk to Yunnan. Okay, Yunnan, I was so excited to have you on here because for the last week or so, the American business press, us included, have been obsessed with this TikTok saga and the U.S. government and Trump. Just a few hours before we started recording, finally signed the executive order banning TikTok in the country if it can't, you know, have a transaction within the next 45 days. But the China story is also so fascinating because, you know, the CEO, Zhang Yiming, was a well-known guy in China before all of this, and you know the whole saga is kind of changing his reputation within the country, or at least has an effect on it. So let's just start at the beginning here. Before TikTok and this whole fight with the U.S. government, what was Zhang Yiming's reputation in China like?
He's a serial entrepreneur, and he previously worked at Microsoft China for a brief time. He's known as a nerdy, but a strategist as well. He's very low profile, rarely speaks to the media. I would say he's considered as one of the new generation of Chinese entrepreneurs who have global ambition from day one. So it's actually in 2014, he wrote a blog post in Chinese titled, "The Golden Age of Chinese Tech Companies is Coming." So in China, people really admire him as he's a person who's growing ByteDance into one of China's most internationally successful internet companies. It's also the first Chinese company to ever launch a global popular product that challenges companies like Facebook and Snap for their global pop culture dominance. So I would say he has a pretty good reputation in China.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me, you know, speaking to people, you know, very close to TikTok and to Zhang Yiming, he really took a lot of pride in the fact that he had built the first Chinese tech company that caught a foothold in the U.S. that was a true global hit, including, you know, this all-important market in the U.S. And this is something he personally was very proud of, right?
Yeah, because I think at the very beginning, he is very determined to build a global company. That not just focus on Chinese market.
Yeah. So let's cut to, you know, more recently. How are people in China reacting to Yiming's decision to potentially sell TikTok to Microsoft and this whole saga itself? I mean, what has been the reaction broadly across the populace in China?
There is a very mixed reaction. A lot of people online are very upset about his decision to sell TikTok to Microsoft potentially. People think the U.S. government or Trump administration is bullying a Chinese company without any concrete legal evidence, especially after the company, ByteDance, has made a lot of effort to success, such as moving its data centers out of China, open to having external parties review its code, and moderating its content moderation policy, and even transfer some of its product manager from China to the US and Singapore. So some have been upset with his decision and have accused him on social media of selling out by bowing to US pressure. In a video that has almost like 500,000 views on Weibo, which is China's equivalent to Twitter, a blogger actually compared how ByteDance has handled the problem to Huawei's response. And he has mocked TikTok's reaction and called Zhang Yiming has no backbone.
When US bans TikTok. Yes, daddy, I'll do anything you want. You want me to review the code? Okay. You want me to sell to an American company? Okay. You want me to fire all the Chinese employees? Okay, I will.
When the same thing happened to Huawei, Huawei was like, screw you, Trump. And in a comparison, what TikTok did was, oh, I will do whatever you ask me to do. If you want me to sell my company to a US company, I will follow. So it's kind of like he was basically calling it a very soft and weak move.
What do you think that is coming from? I mean, is this just kind of a nationalist belief among, you know, people in China, or at least some people in China, that this is just he's not standing up for the strength and the sovereignty of China, that he's sort of bowing to international pressure?
It's kind of like people believe that how he has handled this gonna set an example to what are gonna happen to other companies as well, to other Chinese companies. So if he has chosen to sell the company without any fight, then it's probably gonna make other Chinese company that also have overseas operations make their life much more difficult.
Has this whole episode had an effect on ByteDance in China? We obviously in the US only really care about TikTok because that's the app that, you know, we all use here. But this is a massive company, you know, one of the most, maybe the most valuable private tech company in the world with a massive valuation. Has this whole episode changed at all the way people view the core ByteDance products?
It definitely has some impact. The topic has become a very sensitive one in China. And I think if the online criticism escalates, it could turn into a bigger PR crisis for the company and Zhang Yiming himself. Because after all, China is still the most important market for the company. It's a market that generates the majority of its revenue, especially when it, like currently, they have to adjust their international strategy. I think it's hard to say that people boycott his apps or we haven't seen things like that yet. But I think overall people are watching closely how he's gonna respond.
How has the Chinese government reacted towards this? Or how, you know, the people that you speak to that are kind of close to sort of policy and thinking within, you know, the Chinese Communist Party, how are they viewing this whole episode, and how important is ByteDance to them?
The party or the government hasn't done or said anything officially so far. And I spoke to political risk analyst before, and his view is that it seems that very unlikely that the Chinese government gonna do anything to retaliate US government, because the video app doesn't rise to the same level of importance to the government as Huawei. And also it's getting close to the US election, China doesn't want to be accused of meddling US election. So they probably will not do anything so far. But of course, it's still possible that if Trump continue to escalate, things could change in any seconds, probably. Yeah.
And it's very hard to predict what is going to come out of that administration, policy-wise or word-wise. All right, Yunnan, it's just so fascinating to hear kind of that side of the coin as we're so focused on what's going on over here. So thank you so much for joining. And it's your first time, for whatever reason, on the podcast. We need to have you back on.
Yeah, it's happy to be here.
In February, the Palo Alto-based startup Headspin became Silicon Valley's latest unicorn, surpassing a $1 billion valuation. The company boasted that in just over 4 years, it was on track to generate $100 million in annual recurring revenue, which it was making by selling tools that help companies like Tinder, TikTok, and Walmart test and monitor their apps. But in recent weeks, things have come crashing down. Our own Kate Clark broke the news this week about what happened at Headspin and why it's a cautionary tale for investors and startup employees. Kate, great work on this, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you reported that Headspin's valuation is going to be slashed, its CEO is out, and it is returning nearly $100 million to investors. What happened? Walk us through this.
So this all started with a letter to shareholders that was sent to me by a source. I read through the letter and, you know, initially, because I haven't heard that much about this company in the past, I wasn't really sure what I was looking at or how big of a deal it was. But after reading it a few times, I realized, you know, there was a lot going on here that needed to be reported out. I think the biggest red flag was the fact that investors were saying in this letter that the company had, quote, substantially overpriced, quote, previous funding rounds, and that they were concerned that the financials of the company had been misrepresented to them during those fundraising talks.
Wow. So like misrepresentation of financials during fundraising talks. So this was more than just like the startup was maybe overhyping itself a little bit to investors.
So oftentimes, you know, a company will say something like, we're seeing 25% growth year over year, or we're seeing 300% growth, but they don't necessarily tell you what metric they're referring to. But in this case, the company said in a press release in February that they were on track to post $100 million in ARR in early 2020. I'm not sure what that meant. That might have meant April, May. As it turns out, you know, they have posted about $11 million in ARR in the first half of the year, and they're on track to post about $15 million in ARR by the end of the year. So the reality of the situation is drastically different than the way that it was portrayed to not only investors, but actually to media and to anyone who is reading the company's press releases.
Do you have any sense of how this happened? You reported that this investor letter was the person involved in sort of the investigation here is Nikesh Arora, who's a, you know, very well-respected person in the tech industry, you know, CEO of Palo Alto Networks, formerly of Google and SoftBank. You know, he's involved. He's trying to get to the bottom of this. But how did it happen?
You know, according to my reporting, it seems like there were a few investors, key stakeholders in the company who addressed concerns to Nikesh Arora and to Karim Ferris, who is a partner at GV and an investor in the company for several years. And they led a, you know, essentially a task force or a special committee within the board of directors and that required, you know, hiring an outside firm to analyze the company's financial statements and actually recast the financial statements. And they also hired a forensic accounting firm to look into financial irregularities. Now, I don't have details on what exactly that means, but I think we can all sort of infer that financial irregularities are a big red flag, I think, to any investors or employees for that matter.
And what happens after this investigation? Investors are essentially trying to claw their money back in some way?
Yeah, so Series C investors, according to the shareholder letter, which is set to be agreed upon by Friday. If not, the company may shut down. But it's likely that everyone will agree to these terms of the recapitalization, which is kind of what you alluded to in the beginning when you said the valuation is going to be slashed. So, you know, if investors agree to the recapitalization, the Series C investors will essentially get their money back. A good chunk of Series B investors will get their money back. Earlier investors will be out of luck. They are, you know, they said that they were adjusting employee stock options to sort of ensure that employees are not completely screwed. But It's difficult to know what the future of the company will be. This is a very, you know, big scandal. It's difficult to overcome things like this. And I do question whether the company will have success if they attempt to raise venture capital again in the future, because, you know, there are a lot of questions about why this happened and who was at fault.
And it would be a hell of a comeback if they could make it work eventually. What other, have you gotten any other response to the story? You know, it's, you know, we as reporters like to imagine that there is all sorts of fraud and poor business practices at the companies we cover or at startups, or at least that's the, you know, that's sort of the suspicion always. This was a rare example of like the worst coming true in some respect.
You know, I've heard from a lot of investors that are like, this is my worst nightmare. This is a very frightening story. And, you know, some people have said the proliferation, I think, of just unicorns and the speed at which companies are becoming unicorns, there's potential that there are many situations and instances similar to this that we don't hear about, or, you know, we don't know about yet. So I think, you know, with thousands more companies raising hundreds of millions of dollars at even higher valuations, it makes you wonder how much diligence is really being done and what these companies are saying in these pitches to their investors.
Totally. And I think, you know, this story pairs well with another story you wrote this week, which was, it is one of the most competitive times ever to be a VC searching for deals and good startups. You know, it's boom times again in the tech industry, you know, regardless of what's happening in the world.
Yeah, everyone's looking for their depression era or their company, you know, in the midst of a downturn. They're looking for the next Airbnb or Uber, which were both started during the last downturn. And, you know, here we are again in sort of like a different kind of crisis. And investors want to find that company that's going to be leading us through the next several years as we cope with this virus and kind of all that it's done to our lives.
Okay, thanks so much for joining us. Great work again on this story.
Thanks.
All right, that's today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks, as always, to Ariella Markowitz for producing. And, of course, thank you to Yunnan Zhang, Corey Weinberg, and Kate Clark. Hope you guys all have a great weekend. See you back next time.